The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, it's Patrick Cox here, and this week we're doing a mini-series about people in Britain who helped shape the English language. Yesterday, we heard about a monk known as the Venerable Bede, who documented the beginnings of Old English. The guy we're going to hear about today, he doesn't need much of an introduction.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Right. Here's my report. You must have heard tons of radio stories about William Shakespeare, about kids performing his plays, prisoners performing them, maybe even astronauts reciting bits from Hamlet on the International Space Station. Shakespeare, he's bigger than this world. He's universal. But at the same time, he's sort of local too.
He's seen as the quintessential English or British dramatist.
Maria Delgado is a theatre professor at Queen Mary University of London. She grew up in the UK, the daughter of Spanish refugees, which is something that may have driven her to study Shakespeare.
I mean, Shakespeare's language is full of resonances of Latin, of Spanish, of Germanic terms. I think it was Borges who talked about him as the most Spanish of writers. And the Irish have often said, you know, actually, Shakespeare, it's a myth, he's English, he's actually Irish. So in many ways, somebody we think of as quintessentially English, actually, the roots can be traced back to a series of languages that come from beyond the British Isles.
In begreifen wie ähnlich einem Gott! Die Zierde der Welt, das Vorbild der Lebendigen. Und doch, was ist mir diese Quintessenz von Staub?
Sounds pretty good in German. Not surprising, really, given how closely related English and German are. And it's not just German. English is a stew of other languages. Latin, Old Norse, a few Celtic words, French. Shakespeare's Globe is a reconstruction of an Elizabethan playhouse in London. It was founded in 1997 by American actor and director Sam Wanamaker. It's an open-air theatre, always a hazard in the British climate. Today, in the rain, a group of students is getting a tour. In the evening, the kids are replaced by adults, for the most part, and the tour guides by actors.
Oh, Romeo. Romeo. Wherefore art thou, Romeo? Deny thy father.
Shakespeare done old school, you might say. But the Globe likes to mix it up, too. 2 years ago, it presented performances of Shakespeare's plays in 37 different languages to coincide with the London Olympics. And right now, it has a production of Hamlet touring the world, the entire world, every single country, even North Korea. That's the plan, anyway. Another way the Globe has shaken things up has been to perform Shakespeare in what's called OP, original pronunciation. When the Globe first did it a decade ago, it hadn't been done for 400 years. That's beyond old school. You might think that OP would make Shakespeare more difficult to understand, but it doesn't really. Here's a bit from Romeo and Juliet, delivered in both modern and original pronunciation.
From forth the fatal loins of these two foes.
From forth the fatal loins of these two foes.
A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life.
A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life.
Whose misadventured, piteous overthrows.
Whose misadventured, piteous overthrows.
Do with their death bury their parents' strife.
Do with their death bury their parents' strife.
This is the wife and husband team, Hilary and David Crystal. They've collaborated on a book about places in Britain that shaped the English language. I asked David Crystal, Britain's best-known linguist, I asked him how he knows how Shakespeare's English sounded back then. How does he know, for example, that the word heath was pronounced heth?
One, you look at the rhymes.
Okay. Upon the heath, there to meet with Macbeth. Makes sense.
Secondly, you look at the puns that don't work in modern English, that worked in Shakespeare's time. The spellings are a good guide. That's evidence as well.
Put all that together and you can figure it out, says Crystal. Historians and linguists have been doing just that and finding audiences who want to hear performances in OP.
About a dozen plays have been done in OP now. The early music people have got involved in it. So it's become a bit of a movement now.
But however the words are pronounced, it's the words themselves that have made Shakespeare so pivotal. in the story of the English language. There are, of course, the words he's said to have invented. There was a time when lexicographers attributed as many as 2,500 English words to him.
That figure has come down and down and down. It's currently around about 1,000. And people might say, 1,000? But hang on, I mean, if I introduced one word into the English language, I'd be delighted.
That's also probably how the person who came up with selfie felt. Shakespeare would have liked that word. Which brings up another point about how words come into being. We're not sure who coined selfie. We just know of its first recorded use in Australia 12 years ago. Same with Shakespeare. His plays were often the first recorded use of many English words.
Definitely Shakespearean are all the words, for instance, beginning with un, U-N, like you shout, you unshout in Coriolanus. Or Lady Macbeth asks the gods to unsex her because she wants her feminine qualities removed. Now, words like unshout and unsex and uncurse are coinages, dramatic literary coinages.
Coinages that set a pattern we still follow. Un-American. Uncool. Who can forget Don Johnson's immortal words in Miami Vice? That was uncool, lady. That was major uncool. Just as lasting are Shakespeare's idioms, my lord and master, piece of work, as good luck would have it, kill with kindness.
With language, you should be the master and not the servant. Language is a tool. It does what you want it to do. This is what Shakespeare teaches us to do. He teaches us to dare. Dare to be creative. Push the rules a little bit. If the word isn't there, make one up.
Make one up? Borrow one, perhaps, or borrow a foreign word. You see it time and again in English. Shakespeare just happened to be the best at doing all that. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. More linguistic invention is on the way, or perhaps I should say a little less of it, actually, from Down Under, Aussie slang. But I just got to tell you first about another podcast in the Soundworks network. It's called Radio Ambulante Unscripted. I don't know if you've heard it. It's always a good listen. But the latest episode is a particular interest for anyone who likes languages. It's a conversation with Tanya Saracho. She's a playwright, a border playwright, the U.S.-Mexico border. And she writes and thinks in two languages, two cultures. She's also a TV writer, and she talks about this. It's got her thinking about how Latinos can be portrayed on the English language screen with a bit more nuance, less stereotype than they have been in the past. It's a really good listen, and you can hear it at soundworks.org. Okay, now, the decline of Aussie slang. We've done at least one podcast on Aussie slang. I remember an interview with that great Australian poet, Les Murray. I'll see if I can resurrect that. It was a few years ago, so no promises. But if I can, I'll link to it at pri.org/language. Murray, for quite a while, he's been a sort of keeper of great Australian English slang terms, much more interesting than the usual ones you hear, like Barbie and Chunder and Tinny. I mean, there's nothing wrong with them, but the Aussies can get really inventive. The latest edition of the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang notes that Australianisms are on the decline. This year, the number of new Australian words that made it into the dictionary was at a record low. Here's a report from the BBC's Sydney correspondent, John Donison, a report that starts with a non-Australian whose voice you might just recognise.
Hello, all my friends in Australia. We'd like to do a song that I learned from my friend Cole Joy in Sydney about 10 years ago, and I'd like to translate, in case you don't know what the words mean.
For the untrained ear, the Australian lingo has always proved something of a challenge.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong. Now what I'm trying to say is, once a happy hobo camped by a cool poo.
This is Johnny Cash on tour back in the day.
Under the shade of the coolibah tree. And translated, that means under the shade of the coolibah tree.
Australia has long been a country rich in slang.
Flat out like a lizard drinking.
Budgie smugglers.
Busier than a one-armed bricklayer.
Afternoon to Arvo, journalist to journo.
Barbie. Mate. We're all mates here, mate.
Mate. As in, you know, what the f***.
I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich.
Tony Thorne is the author of the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang.
Australian slang seems to have
really started to build up a head of steam in the late 19th century. The people who went to Australia, especially coming from rich linguistic local traditions like Scotland and Ireland, as well as the East End of London, they were much freer, I think, to play with language in a way that the buttoned-up Brits in those days weren't able to do.
I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast.
And it was one strange lady that served up Aussie slang for a global audience. Dame Edna Everidge was at the forefront of the glory days of Australian slang in the 1970s and 80s.
You see, I'm bilingual as well. I am not only bilingual, but bi-hemispheric.
And it was one of Barry Humphrey's other screen creations, Bazza McKenzie, the hard-drinking, straight-talking Aussie abroad, that ticked all the linguistic boxes of the Australian stereotype.
I was down by Bondi Pier, drinking tubes of ice-cold beer with a bucket full of prawns upon me knee. When I swallowed the last prawn, I had a technical yawn and I chucked it in the old Pacific Sea. Drink it up.
Now, though, it seems Aussie lingo is on the decline. The latest edition of Tony Thorne's Dictionary of Contemporary Slang contains just a handful of new Australianisms.
The kind of Australian culture which Australians were proud of, very macho, very classless, that kind of ochre culture is just out of date. Australia has become a powerhouse now in the financial service sector, and Australians now, when they go abroad, they're not barmen or backpackers, they're working in the corporate sector.
But politicians here are often seemingly behind the linguistic curve, and have recently fallen foul of Australian slang.
Fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate. Well, again, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Can you say fair suck of the sauce bottle in Mandarin?
No, I can't. And beyond that, our good Chinese viewers will not have a clue.
Former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd seriously overdid it with the sauce during last year's election. He's about as singularly unblokey as you can get.
How many times a day do you actually shake the sauce bottle?
This is called pause for thought.
Not often enough.
Here's Tony Thorne again.
We had this hilarious, to me, phenomenon where Tony Abbott, when he was in opposition, ridiculing Kevin Rudd for using what he called these old-fashioned Australianisms. Fair shake of the sauce bottle, fair suck of the pineapple. Abbott's now in power and he's using terms like fair dinkum.
In other words, you know, when a politician's using the language, it really is no longer cool. It just makes you feel a tad bit nauseous.
The BBC's John Donison. And by the way, if you want to see any of the pictures I snapped of the Globe Theatre and some of the other places that put English on the map, well, we have a map, a cool interactive map with photos at the usual place, pri.org/language. I'll be back tomorrow with another edition of this series on the evolution of English. I'll take you to the birthplace of poet John Dryden. He was poet laureate, no less, and he didn't much care for Shakespeare. In fact, he thought that Shakespeare's creativity was a bit too creative. So much so that he tried to establish an Academy of English to regulate the English language. All will be revealed tomorrow about why that project failed. So see you then. And thanks for the Hamlet and Ophelia rapier from MC Lars. To be or not to be, well, I guess that solves that one. And I would have stayed in Wittenberg if I'd known that this would happen. If you're ever up in Denmark on a moonlit night, you'll hear Ophelia's sad song when the full moon's bright. Baby, I'm sorry I messed up. Good night, my sweet princess. May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. And they sing...
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.